Quick note about this episode before we dive in.
This interview
and the intro
were recorded before Ontario passed new bike lane legislation.
So we'll offer Louise an opportunity to address this in a blog post or a future episode of the podcast.
But for now, enjoy one of our most intense episodes. Joe, how many bicycles do you own?
18.
Oh my God, are you serious? When did this obsession begin? Jeez, Louise.
My wife thinks I have a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I would agree with her.
From Webisodes, this is Growability, a podcast at the intersection of urban agriculture, food security, and community.
On this episode, Joe sits down with Luis Patricio, who is very much not an avid cyclist.
Luis is a professor and a PhD student in urban studies and focuses his research on urban design and what he calls mobility poverty.
This was definitely our most controversial episode so far. I have learned a few favorite terms from your conversation with Louise.
Oh yeah, like what?
Moto normativity and car brain are now in my daily vocab, but I was worried at the start that we would be talking about bicycles most of the time.
To be honest, me too, but Louise really ends up describing how our car-focused transportation design affects everything from community to access to healthy food. He even brought a brochure on his research to the interview.
Is that what was on the table in front of him?
Yeah, sadly we didn't get to that.
Well, if you're watching or listening to this and have thoughts to share, send your questions, ideas, and suggestions for future shows to joe@growabilitypod.com.
Siskins, the law firm, hosted us in their beautiful office for this interview, so huge thanks to them for letting us use the space.
And now, grip those handlebars tight and get ready for a wild ride through Joe's conversation with Louise Patricio.
Luis, there are so many reasons I've been really looking forward to this conversation, but my number one reason is that I get to nerd out with somebody about bicycles.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
My pleasure. We're going to give the audience some background on you in a separate intro, but since your bicycle is featured in the room with us, you describe yourself as a person who rides a bicycle. Do you ever refer to yourself as a cyclist, and is there a difference between the two?
I don't generally refer to myself as a cyclist. I don't think as being a cyclist, but I understand that a lot of people do say that.
Right. And
usually when they, you know, like whatever they call me for an interview or something, they always say the avid, it's not just the cyclist, right? It's the avid cyclist.
Yes.
I am starting to get a little itchy with, like, I just ride my bike. Like, you would not say the avid driver, whatever, Michael, something. The person just drives the car to get whatever they need to get to. Right. And this is how I see myself, right? But at the same time, I understand that it's such a different way in North America to get to places that people tend to merge those two things, right? Like merge, make that a bigger part of my identity than right. What it is.
For today, we'll call you Luis. Okay, so the last 100 years have been very car-centric. Why is that a problem?
Why is that a problem? And I think that's the key word you just said is centric, yes. Right? And many times, and you hear the pushback, like, it's a war on cars. Like, you want to get rid of all the cars. Like, how are we going to get around? It's not about getting rid of all the cars or it's about balancing things. There are so many reasons why being car-centric is a problem. And I think it's important to have a good understanding, like a broader understanding of that. Because then you get to solutions like, oh, let's just have electric vehicles and everybody will be happy. Well, if we have over 1 million people getting killed on the roads, and 100% or almost 100% of those accidents, quote unquote, those casualties are involving cars. If they're electric, we still have the problem, right? Like obesity, if you're not taking active transportation, if you're not doing a physical activity to get around, you still have the problem if you have electric vehicles. The way that we developed our city, like urban sprawl and how far we need to go and sometimes a lot of people can go to places. Right. If you're electric vehicles, actually, you're making this problem even harder because they are more expensive. And even when it comes to the environment, one of the last intact ecosystems on the planet, the deep seas, now we're talking about literally a race to the bottom to get to those minerals, to have enough materials to build batteries for cars. So we're talking about destroying an ecosystem that we don't even know what it's there, just to perpetuate a car-centric way of living. And I could go on, but I think we got a good sense of why we need to give more space to other modes of transportation.
And we are going to go on. So this is good. And now all that being said, do you feel that there's an adversarial relationship between people who drive cars and people who ride bicycles?
I think there is an underlying, and it's interesting that people have been researching this now and they have a name for it. And it's, I think naming is very powerful.
Yes.
They call it the car brain.
Okay.
And there's a more scientific term, if you will, that is motor normativity. What that means is that the way that people think about in car-centric places, which is a lot of cities around the world, but very strong in North America, the way that people think about cars and they have a value judgment about what you can, you can't do with when you're using a car is different from everything else.
Right.
One quick example. If you say, would you think it's reasonable and acceptable to use public space to store private property? Can you do that? Is that okay? Framing that way, most people say like, of course, no, it's mm-hmm. public. You shouldn't just put your stuff there. Like, like it's public money. You can't. And then you ask the question, what do you think about free parking on the streets? Should we have that or not?
Okay.
The answers will be dramatically different. There will be many more people that will be in favor and like really strong supporters of parking when all that is storing private property in a public space. So this is one example of when you're talking about cars, our brain shifts completely the way that we think. And I think that underlies, to answer back to your question, I think that underlies how conversations between people who usually drive and people who usually ride a bike can be so adversarial, because they're coming from very different places. And I'd say even people who are cycling, if they live in a car-centric society, they will have that bias as well.
So they will adopt a car brain?
They will
adopt a car protection brain?
Yes.
Right.
They will accept that, for example, free parking is something that it's okay. They would accept that when they're crossing the road, they're going to yield to the driver. They will accept that even when you're walking on the streets and you see a no exit sign, that sign makes sense. I would argue it doesn't. In many cases, there is an exit.
Right.
If you can walk or bike, there will be an exit. Like hardly is the case, there's actually like a wall that you can't go through. So the no exit and the way that just a small example, but the whole way that the city is built and designed is with that car brain in mind, right, is from the perspective of people driving cars. When we talk about, they close the streets for a party. There is 1,000 people in the streets. What do you mean they're closed? They're, mm-hmm. The street is open.
Right.
Again, but again, even if you're a pedestrian or a cyclist, you would use the language, they close the street, and you just feel normal because you're looking from a car, you're using your car brain, right? They open the street.
Right.
Not they close the street.
So people on the streets, natural.
For the most part of human existence, like hundreds, thousands of years, the street was a place for doing business, to meet friends, to socialize, to, markets, celebrations, finding your partner, games, play, like everything. Street is what, urban street primarily, is what makes cities what they are. Cities are a place where you can have many people from many places doing different things. The biggest attraction of cities is other people. and people that can, that need and can offer different things. And the street, the public street, was the epitome of, it was this, the manifestation of that, right? It's when people actually came together. And as you're saying, right, like the last 100 years, when you have a car-centric urban form, then you devoid the street of most of almost every use that they had for thousands of years and become just this right of way. It's just a no man's land, right? Like you're supposed to use the street just to get from A from point B, and primarily by driving or using a motorized vehicle. Like that, there is still many people who believe that bicycles don't belong on the roads, just the cars. When you know that in many legislations, not only they should be there, but they should be prioritized and respect and get the right of way in many ways.
You use the term mobility poverty. Can you talk me through that concept?
That's a great question. And I am so interested in that question that I actually started a PhD at Western University to explore that question. So I'll be, for the next 4 years, I'll be taking a much deeper dive on the topic. And I think this is a great segue because we're just talking about the car-centric, the car brain, right? And mobility poverty is, or transport poverty is the limitation that people have to access what they need. And usually when we talk accessibility, we're talking about wheelchairs and that kind of thing, like accessibility of places. I'm talking about accessibility in a much larger open context. Accessibility in the sense of being able to get to work, being able to get to school, being able to get to a friend's house, to nature, to parks, to the beach in the summer, to a grocery store and acquire healthy foods and everything else you can imagine, places of worship. When we build cities with a car brain, when we build urban spaces that are car-centric, we exclude so many people. There is a book that was published, I think this year, maybe last year, I think it was this year, that is called When Driving is Not an Option. And it's an American book, so it's about the United States. But even the United States, the book is saying that a third of people actually don't drive.
A third.
So if you think about it, we're designing and allocating resources, and we are excluding from the get-go 30. That's a huge number.
It's a huge number.
30% of the population. And in general, we're talking about the most vulnerable groups. And you can think about any dimension. You're thinking about age. So you're talking about folks who are under 16, and they would love to go to their friend's house or, you know, to the gym or whatever on their own and not have to wait every time to be driven by their parents. Or we're talking about senior citizens that might not be able to drive anymore. And there's a lot of research on that is, it's almost like a death penalty in North America when you live your whole life being able to drive and get to places, and all of a sudden you can't, right? Because of physical or financial, whatever situations. And you think about newcomers or people of color or people with physical disabilities that can't drive because they can't see. Mm-hmm. So if you put all those groups together, they are close to the 50%, in some cases, even the majority of the population, and you're not catering to all of them. So mobility poverty or transport poverty is that limitation that excludes people to get, and here in London it's tragic, actually. I was going to say funny, but it's actually tragic that there's so many even job posts that one of the last line is access to a vehicle, right? Or having a driver's license. I would understand if you're hiring a driver.
Sure.
So it's part of the job. But those are jobs, those are office jobs, right? And they say, if you don't have a driver's license, you can't get the job. It doesn't matter how much experience you have. It doesn't matter your background. If you don't have a car, you don't belong in this society. You don't have access. You don't have the right to even apply to this job. So this is a little bit of what transport justice is.
So how does moving away from a car-centric community build community? When we take the car out of the equation, how does that build community?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, the car can have a smaller role, but the car is still part of the equation, right? Again, it's not an all or nothing. There is a place to have cars and have personal motorized transportation, but much, much less. And as cyclists, we kind of know some of the answers to that question, right?
We've done the research.
Yeah. Well, from lived experience, right? And exactly. From an individual standpoint, the connection that you can build with people and your surroundings is so much tighter, is so much deeper. I did, you're saying like we did the research, and actually I did kind of a personal experiment. I was counting how many people smiled to me on my way to work, and I was biking, and I counted for 2-3 months every day. And on average, I would get 7-8 smiles every day. And by smiles, I mean, like you're just biking by and you're slow enough that people can actually look in your face and they'll give you, you know, just little nod and like a little bit, like just a quick smile. And I think that alone in a society that is becoming more and more polarized, that is hard to see each other, just being able to be in a public space with others and have that, those, there's a guy from London here that talks about micro neighborliness. And I think this is like a great example of what that is.
Right.
It's just, and some of those people were the same people over and over again. And like when I'm riding that bike with my kids, they would remember the kids. The days I didn't have the kids, they're like, hey, you forgot someone. Like, what happened? And you know, that those little jokes on a daily basis, I think can really make your day. Just building community.
Yeah.
You know, it's a friendly face, it's a familiar face. And it might sound like a small thing, but if you think of thousands of people being able to experience that on a daily basis, when you add that up, it really makes a big difference. And then when we think about some of the challenges that we have in a car-centric society, when we have the car as a smaller part of the equation, you would have more space.
Right.
Here in London, for example, there's a podcast. I'm not associated with the guy in any way, but it is an interesting podcast. It's called Not Just Bikes. He's from London, now lives in the Netherlands.
Very interesting.
And, yeah. And he uses London as one of his examples of how not.
He does do that.
Yes. Build a city. So in cities like London, for example, you would have in some neighborhoods more than 50% of the area, like the whole land, urban land, dedicated to cars in forms of like roads, parking lots, gas stations, and you name it, everything. So if you think about it, if you have less need for cars and you're focusing on bikes and public transit, think about all we could do with that space. Like, shouldn't be housing the main use of land, or I don't know, education or work or productive things, instead of just spaces where you can either store cars or move them around. So shifting away, and again, like with the car brain, it's hard to think, how does that look like if you don't have a car? It does feel like that death penalty. You're like, oh my God, I can't do anything. But you actually have examples in other parts of the world where you have public transit that is efficient, that comes every 5 minutes. Like, honestly, waiting 5 minutes, is it that bad? And if you have enough public transit and you're not crowded in the bus, is it really that bad? And if you can have, you know, a super safe protected bike lane, if you don't want to wait 5 minutes, but you know you're going to be safe, is it really that bad? So there's many advantages, economic, social, environmental benefits to moving away from the car-centric. But it does take, I think sometimes like seeing is believing.
Right.
I wish I could just, you know, pay a ticket for everyone to go to some of those countries, like, you know, visit Copenhagen or Amsterdam and just see for themselves what it looks like, a city that doesn't, you know, need to have all that many cars. Tomorrow is World Car Free Day.
Yep.
And there are cities, and Car Free Day is actually a living lab. That's what it is.
It is.
It's supposed to be an experiment where you're like trying things that hopefully can be permanently implemented. Like it's to just become part of the city. And in Bogota, for example, they close, quote unquote, so many roads for cars, which means that people can walk and bike for hundreds of kilometers. And they put more buses because a lot of people drive and they can't drive anymore. What they're going to do? So they actually create alternatives for people to get around. But it becomes this huge public park and it's the entire city. It's unbelievable. I think anyone from here that would go spend a World Car Free Day in Bogota would just, it would be mind blowing for them in a good way.
It's interesting. You mentioned 7 or 8 smiles. That sounds like a micro vacation for a lot of people on their commute to work or to school. And when you speak about mobility poverty, I see it ties in with a lot of work that we do around food insecurity. Mm-hmm. Do you see bonds between the two? Do you see ties between the two? Do you think that there are commonalities?
Food and mobility?
Food insecurity and mobility poverty.
Several ties. Okay. I was talking to someone who works at the food bank, and they're saying that the bicycle to some of those people is a lifeline, really. Mm-hmm. They rely on the food bank on a daily basis, some of those people. And if they have a bicycle, they can get there and back to wherever they need to go. Sometimes they don't have a place to go. They're living in a homeless situation. And they can get there and back faster, and they can carry more stuff.
Right.
And usually once they get a bike, and we do have a good place. We have this Quickie Wheel Bike co-op here in town that helps provide affordable bikes for people who don't have a lot of money to spend on transportation. If they have a bike, it's free, right?
Right.
Even if they have to take the bus, they have to pay for the tickets, yes, to get there and back. And obviously, if they're using the food bank, they can't afford to have a car. And then they say, well, and some of those people who don't have a bike, they only can carry food for 1-2 days, and maybe they can't come back soon enough. So there'll be 1-2 days without food at right. all. This is one of the many links, right? Like I'm from Brazil, like one link that comes to mind is like we have biofuel, right?
And yes.
We're actually destroying a lot of our natural habitats so we can grow corn or sugarcane.
Okay.
So we can feed the cars. So there's so many other ways that we can use the land to either feed people or just preserve, right? Like the, how they call the lungs of the world, like the right. Amazon and things like that. And even if you think about, we're talking about using spaces, how about urban agriculture?
Right.
Like in my head, I always imagine when I go by those parking lots downtown, if they're actually farms, you know, like big long rows or farms, people coming together, community gardens, instead of storing cars, we're growing food together.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. I would love to see that. I would love to like just throw that idea out there in the world and see if, you know, someone actually, yeah, like let's just, yeah, you know, take a little bit of space for cars and let's feed people together.
One parking space is a pretty good garden.
Yeah.
Okay. We've talked about wonderful places all over the world. We've talked about struggles. There's something that can be created in any city, and that's the 15-minute city. Mm-hmm. You could probably speak to it far better than I. What do you think about the 15-minute city?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And I've seen it being implemented in some cities in Europe where it came from Spain. And it is, as you're saying, it can be, in terms of the amount of work and investment that it needs to happen, it depends on how the city is built. The denser it is, the easier it is to just diverge from car-centric planning and create spaces for people to get around in other ways. And then the services will be already there, right? Because the city is dense, it's compact. For other cities who are more sprawled, then you need a little more like the upfront investment to make things a little tighter. And just for to have like a reference point, like I said, I'm from Brazil and I come from a city that is called Curitiba.
Okay.
Some of the folks in that are part of the urbanist, urban planning, architecture world, they heard about Curitiba before because that's the birthplace of the bus rapid transit system. Okay. The first BRT in the world was implemented in Curitiba. This is back in the 70s. And Curitiba at the time had 450-ish people, which is how many people we have in London right now. Mm-hmm. But Curitiba now currently has, the greater area has 3.5 million people.
Wow.
The city proper, like just Curitiba itself, has about 2 million now. But the area is the same as London. So in terms of space, Curitiba and London has the almost the same size. But Curitiba has 4 to 5 times more people than London. So when I'm talking about density, and you can, you know, we can go and Google and see areas and populations and see how it compares. But cities in North America tend to be way more sprawled. So the 15-minute city takes a little more work to implement, but it can start as soon as we want. There are many neighborhoods in London that are dense enough to do that. And with, we have a BRT that is, there, we're right here. Like if you can, if you look through the windows here, you can see some of the lines, right? Unfortunately, they're just building the east and the south branches. They canceled the north and west. A great way to make a 15-minute city here, right here in London, is to actually revisit and re-implement like as soon as possible, get those north and west branches up and running again.
And for our city planners, for our community planners, is this how we're going to address mobility poverty long-term? The 15-minute city concept?
I hope so. And there is a pushback in North America about the concept. And I think it comes from a misunderstanding. And I'll go back. I think it comes from the car brain, from really not be able to even imagine what life where the car is not the primary mode of transportation is. We're talking about, here in London, we're talking about 70 to 80% of trips being made by car. I'll use Curitiba as an example again, like in Curitiba where you have the BRT for now almost 50 years, no, I think more than 50 years now. I think it's 30, 35% of the trips are made by car. And a lot of people do use the bus rapid transit. We don't have a lot of people cycling. We don't have a lot of investment in cycling there. But then again, you have the biggest city in the world, you have Tokyo, and it's one of the, you know, mega cities, and you have 20, 24% people cycling. So it is possible even in, you know, very large, very big cities to have, to invest in active transportation, get people riding. But it has to be safe and it has to be convenient.
Yes.
People like us, we're like middle-aged men, able-bodied, educated, and we just do it.
We just do it.
We just do it.
Yeah.
And we don't. It's not really that hard for us. But when you start thinking about, you know, a newcomer who doesn't even speak English,
right?
Who doesn't even understand the signs? It's like the whole. So many things are alien, right? Or you think about a mom, a young mom with, you know, young kids on a bike riding at night. Like things get way more. You need to have the level of quality to allow people to use public transit or cycling and feel safe. We can and we should do way better.
And this brings to a good point, and especially with newcomers utilizing bicycles coming here. Cars are normalized, but riding the bicycle is seen as abnormal, or maybe we're fringe. This is how it's viewed. What do you think of that?
I agree. I see, and I've worked with many organizations, right, that support newcomers in different ways.
Right.
One of the ways was through the Squeaky Bike Co-op, and we have bikes for newcomers. And many of these stories that we hear is that some of the immigrants, they have a different idea of what Canada is, and they think, oh, I will be able to, I am looking for a more sustainable lifestyle. I want to, you know, get rid of my car. And when I move to Canada, I'm just going to bike or use public transit. And when they come here, they just face this harsh reality, right?
Right.
And like I said, some of them, like, if I don't have a car, I can't even get a job. And it could be different things, right? Sometimes is, I don't speak English yet.
Yep.
I can't even take the written exam.
Right.
So I can.
For a vehicle.
For a driver's license. So I can get the first stage to get a driver's license.
Yes.
Right. I can't even do that. So I have to wait. Other times, and in the booklet that we published, the Unseen Commuters, we talked to a few newcomers. Other times they just don't have the means to,
right,
to have a vehicle, to own a vehicle. We have our low income population, but newcomers are overly represented in that way, close to 50%. So we're talking about half of the people who come to Canada that, you know, they need refugees, and sometimes they, you know, lost a lot of what they had. They really can't afford to have a car. And we are making it really hard for them to integrate, because it's not only about finding a job. It's, you know, building those social relationships, going to places, joining a gym and things like that. We're making it hard for them to integrate, and we're making it hard for them to be able to start a new life. You're asking about the intersection, right, of food and mobility. And then you see how mobility justice and mobility poverty overlaps with many of the other social issues. When you think about mental health crisis, when you think about obesity, high obesity levels, even among kids, when you think about affordability for many things, like mobility poverty will be foundational to address many of those things. If we can make, and the answer is not, again, it's not, let's make sure that everybody can afford a car.
Right.
Because we know that there are many other issues with everybody having a car. The answer is like, how can we make transportation costs less? And public transit and cycling, or the 15-minute city,
right,
are some of the ways that we can address, that we can make transportation costs lower.
Okay, I have a question for you. Talking about mobility poverty, do you feel that people that ride bicycles and people that have physical mobility challenges have things in common?
The people who ride bicycles and the people who have I think in some ways, they are invisible. I think this is one of the things that they might have in common, is how places are, people in general, they just don't think about what their needs are. In small and big ways, like when you think about like the big citywide planning, right? How we even discuss if you're going to plow the sidewalks or not. Again, as able-bodied people, you can just hop through whatever it is, go on the street for a bit and come back. But if you're in a wheelchair, or if you have sight loss or any or other things, it can be hard. It's just, and the same for cycling, right? Like this in citywide, you can start building bike lanes, but the network will be as strong as the weakest link.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if you have an amazing bike lane for just part of the way that you need to go, and then you throw cyclists in a busy road. It doesn't matter. Like the people are not, just not going to bike. You know, like places to park, park your bike when you arrive to places, or it's just not, you're just not on people's radar when you're using a bike to ride in the city. And I think in many ways, people with disabilities, they're not in the radar for the different needs that they have.
Thank you. Okay, let's dream for a second. What would the ideal urban environment look like for you in the context of mobility poverty?
I think we talked a lot. We touched on a lot of the things. To me, is I don't want to sound that it's a romantic vision. That is just the going back to the past. At the same time, I don't think we are in this linear trajectory with, you know, we're just getting better and better. I think there are lessons from our past that we can take. And I think there's technology that we should embrace and adopt. What I mean by that is, like what we were saying, how streets were used for so many different things in the past. And now it's become more and more rare to see those things. I think, to me, ideal urban space, the streets, they have that multiple use again, right? It's one of the principles of sustainability and permaculture, is anything has multiple uses. And I think SunFest, for example, the festival here in London, where you have so many different people from so different backgrounds, they all come together to the park, and you know, and you have the vendors, and you have food, and you have I sometimes I go to SunFest and I'm asking myself, how can we make, not a big festival, not that I, you know, want to every weekend be dancing like crazy in the streets, but how can we make this more of a reality? How can we normalize urban public spaces where we have more people coming together and spending time together? So ideal urban space for me is that, you know, the neighborhood where people are walking, going from their houses, and there's like a little grocery store, bakery, and they can get stuff, and it's easy, and there's several in every neighborhood, and you know, there's this quirky little store. It's just like the standard. Not everybody has the same thing, but every little neighborhood has its own character and identity. And people have more dignity because, you know, they don't need to own a car to access all of those things. They can walk to places. They can bike to places. They can take transit. And they can drive if they want, but they don't have to. They have a real choice. And I think one of the main things of ideal urban space or city is dignity. Like everybody just feels that they belong and that they can be the best version of themselves that they want. They are encouraged and they feel that they can pursue that. Whether it's, you know, we're talking about professionally or socially or whatever it is, like your hobby, but you are, even if you're not wealthy in terms of your income, but you are able to access all of those things in the city.
Part of community.
Yes. Yeah.
People are always saying to me, I'd love to get rid of my car, but I can't.
They're right. Yeah. And when I have this conversation with other people, like when I have this conversation with friends or at a party, I would not have the conversation the same way that we're having, because I think right. people get defensive quickly, mm-hmm. like they feel guilty. And I don't want them to feel that at all, because I understand that it's hard. On a North American city, and this is what transport justice is about, like it is hard to not have a car. Like you actually excluded. You become a second class citizen mm-hmm. if you don't have a car. You have so many things taken away from you. I wrote a blog recently on my a blog post on my blog that is about the right to enjoy the summer. Like if you don't have a car, and you know that, like we've been to Port Stanley, yes, right? Like we are able to do that, but not everybody is. And many of the people who don't have a car. Mm-hmm. How do they go to the beach? And it's crazy to think that we had 100 years ago, we had public transit, electric, that would take 1,000 people every day between London and Port Stanley.
Yeah.
100 years ago. So it's not a question of, do we have the technology for this? Do you have the means? We're doing this 100 years ago.
100 years.
With 1,000 people every day. But now we are making different choices. We're prioritizing different things. And many people don't have access to enjoy the summer. And again, you think about the vulnerable populations and low-income families that you want to provide low barrier or affordable options for them. Like you would think that going to the beach, you know, it's a public space, it's free, it's as big as can get, so you can have you can have lots of people on the beach, and still people just can't get there. And, you know, the city provides a lot of options for summer camps and things like that, but it comes with a cost.
Of course.
Why can't we just go back to basics and, again, access to public space where people can meet other people as equals, have that diversity. It's one, and I keep going back to that because I think it's one of the big challenges that we have in our society today. Like people are so polarized because we're increasingly living our lives online using social media. And it changes something in your brain when you're not actually seeing a human being, when you can actually see someone in the eyes. They have this beautiful experiment that they put someone looking each other in their eye for, I don't remember, 30 seconds, 2 minutes, something like that. And it's impossible not to cry because that human connection is so strong. Be able to create the conditions for those human face-to-face in-person interactions, even if it's not your closest friend or your family, but just to be able to be with other human beings and in a civilized way and having fun at the beach, I think it's crucial. And we need to rethink how we make this possible for those who would like to get there without a car because they can't drive.
You know, I think a lot of how people use cars,
mm-hmm.
it's the disconnect. It is the opposite of building community.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really hope that that's not by design.
I think it's one of those yes and no answers.
Right.
I definitely see that part of the appeal is you own your life.
Yes.
You do whatever you want. You go and leave when and where you want because you're on your own and, you know, and you can, gosh, not only listen to music, but nowadays you can watch movies in your car. Yeah, right. Like, don't get me started with that. but there is part of the discourse is like, the car is your sanctuary and you're on your own, you're independent, you own your life, you're disconnected. And it's interesting that part of my academic work with mobility and was talking to drivers and cyclists and bus passengers. And it was so interesting to see the juxtaposition of one of the biggest concerns of car drivers, and we're researching why people choose their mode of transportation. So one of the biggest concerns of car drivers, people driving, was it's unsafe. I don't feel safe if I'm not in my car. But they don't know because they are driving.
Right.
So they are making assumptions and they are fearing something that they don't know, that they don't have the experience. And then you're talking to, and those groups I'm talking about, that research specifically was employers.
Yes.
From the same company. So they were going to the same place and they were using the same routes. So we're talking about, there's a lot of overlap there. So, and the people that walk or bike or use public transit, one of the biggest highlights, one of the big benefits of using or biking or walking is that they were able to connect, to see other people.
Right.
So the very same thing that would discourage drivers to start biking was the thing that the cyclists would cherish the most.
Yes.
But the people who drive, they were speaking from a place of, I want to say, ignorance. They didn't know what they're talking about because they didn't try. And many of the cyclists and that workplace is a place with people with means. So they're not using bikes because they couldn't afford a car. They're choosing to bike. They know what it is. They know they drove to work a few days, but they would bike regularly once, twice a week. After being exposed, if you will, to what it is to bike to work, they didn't think it was a bad thing. They actually thought it was great. It's the 8 miles a day, right?
Miles a day.
It's the same. Was the same thing for them. They were experiencing that connection with others. So I guess the question becomes, you know, if it's a selling point, I think, yes, it's in some cases it's part of the discourse and no, like it's unfounded. Right. In many cases, they're missing the fun.
It's not quantified.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the environment. Do you consider your, I guess in our society, we'll call it bicycle alternative transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider your utilization of alternative transportation a component of personal environmental stewardship?
100%.
Yeah.
And sometimes I teach environmental stewardship at Huron University. And sometimes I'm trying to give some scientific or more objective ways of showing how those things compare. One of the examples that I use is that the amount of energy that you need to drive for 10 kilometers is the same amount of energy that you need to ride a bike from here to Montreal.
Okay.
And usually people have a hard time understanding what I'm saying and accepting. But that's how much energy we need to lead a car-centric lifestyle. And as efficient as we can get on how we use for transportation, every other thing that we need to lead our lives, it's not just about efficiency. We really need to talk about reducing, right?
Reducing.
Everybody heard about this even in school, the three R's.
Of course.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce is the first one. Recycle is the last resort. Reuse is a second option. The first one, when you're talking about sustainability, environmental sustainability, is reduce. And the amount of energy that we use when you're driving is enormous. And there's so much that we can reduce if we're using public transit or cycling. There's so much room for improvement. So that alone, and I started with energy because energy really underpins every sustainability conversation.
Of course it does.
The reason we are smart folks, you know, humanity as a
from time to time, sure.
Yeah, since sometimes they have some good ideas, you know, and have all this innovation and new technology and AI and all this good stuff. But none of this would be possible if we didn't have such a huge, concentrated, easy to transport energy.
Yes.
Power, which is oil and gas,
right?
They're either in a liquid form or, you know, gas form, even easier. And they have such a concentrated amount and volume of power that we can, the growth that we see in terms of population, in terms of urban growth, technology, and everything else, it's primarily because we have the energy. That energy will come to an end. We already passed the peak. It doesn't mean that we're at zero, but it is getting, they call it the EROI, energy return on investment. The energy return on investment, the energy that we get from oil nowadays, it's much lower than when, like 56 years ago, when you just tripped and there's like, have a new spring of oil and it was so easy. And now we have to like drill super deep or go to the ocean, or it takes much more time and resources to get that oil than it did. And this really, so whether we want or not, there will be a decline in how much, and with the growing population, how much we can use. Anything we talk about the environment, we need to have that basic understanding that we will have less energy and that we have a growth mentality, because it has been this, like you mentioned, like 100 years of car-centric, right? And a lot of that is tied to how much more energy we had available. We had, and if you go back, have like just human powered and then animal, horse powered, and then you have coal, and then we have oil. We've been in this growth trajectory of having more and more powerful energy sources. This will not continue forever. So the mindset that growth is the only way and everything else is not a desirable way to live because we can't grow, needs to change. And this underpins the environmental discussions, is how to live. And I'm a firm believer that we would be much happier if you had less. You know, have those experiments where, you know, you go to a supermarket and then you have 30 options of strawberry gin. And you go to another one, you have 3. And it's so much better. Like, it's easier. It's so overwhelming to have that many options.
Sure.
That people get frustrated. And sometimes it's like, I don't know what to do with this. So the idea, one of the fundamental ideas when you're talking about environmental sustainability, and it relates totally to mobility, living on an age of hypermobility where you want to get faster and further, more and more, is that more is not always better. There is a peak, there is an ideal, and I think we shift away from that ideal.
And we're missing things.
Yeah.
Okay, we've talked about where we were going, but let's talk about post-car society.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see that looking like?
I love the question, Joe. Yes. I really like that question. I like that question so much that I actually last year I ran a simulation called Living Room Cities. And I created a scenario where we, hypothetical, not that crazy, but a scenario where cars would not be allowed anymore. You need to have like special permits if you wanted. We're talking about the emergency vehicles and this and that, but people in general, like normal citizens, would not be allowed to have a car. Like you have to get, you know, figured out a way. And obviously cities would have to prepare themselves to have public transit and cycling and all those things. In that scenario that I was creating, and we did like a community simulation, there were 15, 20 people doing the simulation. Lots of great ideas and things that I never thought of. And I think it's so important to exercise our imagination, our muscle in that way, and really just think about out of the box and not assume that the way that we live today is the only way to live. Mm-hmm. But I am not so sure that in my scenario, we had time to plan. It was a collective political decision and we have time to plan. When we talk about post car societies, we might not have a smooth transition, right? And to me, the main concern is social justice.
Yes.
So when we transition, and we will, how do we ensure that those who already don't have access to many things, how can we ensure that we bring this to a more balanced state? And maybe in a way, just by not having cars and automobiles available to everyone, this will bring things to a more balanced. That's my hope. And everything starts falling into place. If you even think about the big box stores,
sure,
that you have usually in the outskirts of the city, if you don't have the car as, you know, the primary mode of getting around, 70-80% of the people using that, like, they don't make any sense. They're so hard. Like, even when you get to the parking lot, just to get to the store is so far. And the amount of stuff that you need to buy, like some of those big stores, and you're, you know, if you're whether you're biking or if you're, and again, we have the big bikes, right? We can carry loads and loads. Right. But if you think about the average person, they can carry lots of bags, whether they're using public transit or a bike. Oh, the a post car society is, you know, it's a society that has less big boxes.
Yes.
And it has many more neighborhoods. Local business, small stores, and the diversity in those are amazing. Like you have the homemade local products, super unique and quirky and fun and special and meaningful, right?
Right.
It's someone who built this or know from who they bought it, or it's just such a different relationship. It's, things are more durable, you know, just like buying every week and loads and loads and carts and carts. So you're on your bike. You're buying just what you need. Anyone buys something that will last for a lifetime. And this is the kind, it's funny because probably a term that many of us heard, the Anthropocene.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the human, us humans, changed the earth in such a big and dramatic way that is completely altering global biophysical patterns. And then after that, there were like several scenes that were created.
Yes.
You have the Capitalocene and the Thanatocene and the Phagocene. And one talks about the overconsumption and consumerism lifestyle. And the description of that, I think, is the Phagocene. The
okay.
description of that pinpoints the automobile and the suburban lifestyle as the main condition to lead a lifestyle that is about overconsumption.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
If we can't ban cars and we look at our big box stores, can we ban the parking lots? We don't have the parking lots and we don't have the roads. Do we need the big box stores? You talked about going and buying what we needed. That's developing community.
Mm-hmm.
What do those stores look like without parking lots? How useful is a big box store without a parking lot?
And I'm imagining this new future, right? I'm imagining this new possibility. The big box stores, they really become community centers. It's one of those big shifts, and we're talking about the environmental sustainability, yes, right? Like the new ways of living. One of the shifts is us as consumers to us as producers.
Right.
So those community centers, when we don't need to have this big box store to, you know, buy things in bulk, sure, every week, all that space available becomes, you know, like a repair workshop where, right, you know, people go to just learn how to fix their own things. And we have a few examples here, right? You have the DIY repair workshops, yep, and we have the Squeaky Bike Co-op that you can fix your own bike. But this becomes a much bigger undertaking. It's like a citywide spread, and people come together. Again, the value of the city, right? Like, yep, people coming together, people that have many different needs and many different skill sets. So it becomes a center. Like, I know how to fix a bike, and I know how to fix a camera, and I know how to fix, you know, pants, and I don't know, and it can be like a childcare, it can be a urban farm as well, like a greenhouse, because it's indoors and we have, you know, harsh winters. So it could become so many different things.
And building community,
like we're coming together in those big spaces to use as producers, not as consumers.
So I've asked you a lot of questions and we've covered a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you'd like to cover today that we did not talk about?
Can I put a few personal?
You sure can.
Plugs about projects and ideas and things that I've been working on. So we talked a lot about transportation and urban mobility and things like that. And I mentioned that I'm starting a PhD. One of the projects that I am working on is, and I alluded to that in our conversation, is to create a safe route for everyone from London to Port Stanley.
Yes.
I think this is on the way. I think we have cycling infrastructure in London, and Sunset Drive, when we get to Port Stanley, is separated, is on the sidewalk, but we're missing a few chunks in the middle.
Okay.
And we had a CBC interview, and if anyone is interested in knowing more or getting involved or supporting this, please reach out to me. We also have...
And can I ask, how would they reach out to you?
So my website is luispatricio.ca.
Thank you.
And if you can share this in any way, shape, or form.
We can
do
that.
Yeah. And they have a contact form there that is easy. And I always check that form. The other one is the Vision Zero. The city adopted Vision Zero principles in 2017. I think there's a lot of work to be done and to improve that. And we're hoping to put forward ideas on how to advance. Right. A reminder that just a few days ago was the 2-year anniversary of Jimin Benoit's death.
Yes.
He was killed on Hamilton Road by a person driving a car. And as much as we want to find the guilty driver, I think Vision Zero, for those who don't know what it is a much bigger discussion. It understands that everybody fails.
Yes.
It's whether you're a cyclist, you're a driver, like if you will make mistakes, and we need to build and design cities that allow those mistakes to happen without loss of life. So there's a bigger responsibility of urban planners. So there is another project that we want to move forward. It's the Vision Zero here in London. Again, you can read some of that on my website, and you can reach out to me.
Okay.
And also on the website, we published, if you want to know more about mobility justice, we published a little booklet called Unseen Commuters.
Okay.
And it's also, you can also find that on the website. And yeah, like honestly, because we talk about so many interconnections, if you feel that anything that you're working on many of those social issues do overlap with transport, I'd love to hear from you. Like I said, I'll be doing a deep dive for the next 4 years of my life on this. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thank you. I have one last question.
Yeah. Yeah.
What keeps you growing?
What keeps me growing? I don't remember if I saw this on a movie or where I saw this, but it's something like, it doesn't matter. We're saying like the alternative, right? Like we're the fringe. If being the normal, if being the champion, if being the popular is being on the side of things that doesn't align with my values, like I don't want to win. Like I want to be the loser. I think what keeps me growing is that hope that we can normalize so many of those things. They're really, in many ways, they're so close. They're so close. It's really that change in mindset and attitude. I believe that we physically shape the world with our minds. Like a lot of, and I'm not just talking about buildings, but even every social contract, like money, marriage, mortgages, like everything, it only exists because it was here before.
Right.
So what keeps me growing is that, you know, that seed in my head of the possibilities of how beautiful our lives can be if you just want to make them so.
Thank you. Luis, thank you so much for spending time with us today and being part of Growability.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Joe. That was really fun.
Growability is hosted by Joe Gantzeflis and Holly Pugsley and produced by Joe Gantzeflis and Adam Kaplan. Special thanks to this week's guest, Luis Patricio. Lighting and camera design by Kevin Labonte, with production support from Oliver Gantzeflis. Growability's production was made much easier with the help of Jesse Chen, Terry Fujioka, Zach Grossman, Zachary Meads, Leo Shin, and Deborah Camargo from Fanshawe College's Broadcasting, Television, and Film Production Program. Thanks to Janice Robinson from Fanshawe for arranging for these students' invaluable participation. Holly Pugsley of Just Keep Growing provided the plants and made sure they looked great. Audience and Marketing Strategy by Japs Karmiglani, with support from Dorantina Uka and Tess Alcock. Our theme music is Wandering William by Adrian Walter and can be found on Soundstripe. Thanks as well to Hubert Orlowski for providing technical and audio engineering advice to help our podcast sound great. Adam Kaplan, that's me, is Webisode's executive producer, and Sammy Orlowski is our senior creator. Special thanks to Jennifer Routley from Siskins the Law Firm for arranging to host us at their beautiful head office in downtown London, Ontario. Growability is a Webisodes production and is produced with the support and participation of the team at The Patch and Hutton House.